Production. Recorded live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining in. This is another episode of Intentionally Inclusive. My name is Tracy Brown, and I am so glad that you are finding this series of interest to you, and I hope you're getting a lot out of it. If you have not already visited the website Stained Glass Spirit, then I encourage you to do so. At the website, we update a couple times a week with either things that are in the news or resources related to attracting diversity, creating inclusion in spiritual communities. So in Stained Glass Spirit, we're really focused on the idea that diversity is a divine idea, an idea from God, a purposeful, creative expression of the unlimited potential of life itself. And because of that, we want to have spiritual communities that encourage and engage everyone. This series, Intentionally Inclusive, is really giving you an opportunity to listen in, almost eavesdrop, on a series of conversations that I'm having with a variety of people about what it means to be inclusive, how that shows up in their lives and in their commitment to build and grow and be a participant in inclusive spiritual communities. So today, I'm really excited. I wish you could see me. I have this big smile on my face because I am excited to have a conversation with Walter Drew. I'll tell you a little bit about him, and then we'll dive into the conversation. Walter Drew is an amazing man with a lot of experience. He spent a lot of his adult life in the construction industry in one way or another. He's been a general contractor. He has run a general contracting firm that was very successful. And he is known now as someone who is a very talented mediator, and he conducts or he facilitates, maybe that's a better word, mediations and arbitrations involving different aspects or different members of the construction community, from land use planning to partnership agreements to dealing with contractors and subcontractors. He's touched every aspect of that field. And in addition to that part of his life, he has been a very active and influential leader in Centers for Spiritual Living for more than 10 years. And in the last decade, he has had a lot of influence in his leadership role as a laity member working with the Core Council and now the Leadership Council, helping to draft the strategy for the organization and manage the operation of Centers for Spiritual Living. So that's who I get to talk to today, and you get to listen in. So, Walter, thanks so much for agreeing to have this conversation with me. How are you today?
I'm just fine, and it's my pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I just, when I was considering people to invite, I invited a broad cross-section of people to have this conversation, this kind of conversation with me. And I didn't know if you would say yes or not, but I was so delighted when you responded, yes, of course, I'm happy to do it. And some people would say, well, what does Walter Drew have to say about diversity? He's a straight white guy, you know, who's had a lot of success in life. And, you know, why does he care at all about diversity? And I'm guessing you've been asked that before. So how do you answer that question?
Well, I care about diversity because I care about people. And I was raised in a family. My mother was a German immigrant. And we always had people from different faiths and different races at our house. We lived near Brown University, and there was an effort made on the part of my parents to introduce. I'm the oldest of five children within 7 years. And we were raised in a international household and with a sense of equality for all people.
I love that. And I'll be quoting that. Why do you care about diversity? Because I care about people. And so much, especially from our spiritual foundation, makes that easy to say. And sometimes we don't realize we're not actually executing on that belief. But I have been around you enough to know that you consistently execute on that belief. I'm curious about what you may have experienced in the construction industry over your years that either represented diversity or represented lack of sensitivity to diversity.
A great question. Within my crew, we had a variety of people. We had Native Americans. We had Hispanic people. We had, at one point, a highly educated group of people. There were two PhDs, three of us with master's degree, and the laborers all had college education. There were about a dozen of us working. It was just sort of a unique situation back in the 70s. One of the things that I learned, and it was unfortunate, that we basically worked for people who had money. And I became so aware of the differences of how people handled their money and how people conducted themselves. And I can give you an example. Some people viewed me and construction people as the enemy, and they were out to get us because they felt we were out to get them. And other people who treated us with kindness, and it just made a huge difference in terms of the output of the crew and the overall attitude of the worker in concert with the owner. And I was sort of the go-between.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me that we know diversity exists, and sometimes we use it and we, you know, create categories of people, so beyond race and beyond gender, but we'll use those categories to either get what we want or to create barriers between other separated groups of people. And I think that probably happens in every industry as well as in our neighborhoods and communities. And it's unfortunate because what we know is that we'll never get rid of labels. It's the stories we make up about the labels and the behaviors we have that either bring people together or separate them or encourage them to dislike each other or challenge each other.
As you're saying that, I realized that I used a group, the rich people, and that you're exactly correct in the fact that we not only make up labels, but then we look for ways to justify that, and we start telling stories, either positive or negative, that support our categorizations, if you will.
Yeah, and really from a sociological point of view, that's exactly what happens. So, you know, it's sometimes people will ask me in the work that I do in organizations around diversity, inclusion, and leadership development, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, Tracy, isn't the goal to just eliminate all the labels? We're just all the human race. And And it's funny, you know, I do often say, no, the labels are not the problem. It's the stories we make up about the labels that are the problem. Because we have labels in every species of life, in every category of everything we do. So we don't go out to, in Dallas, we have an arboretum, and in many cities there's, you know, a botanical garden or a park. And we don't go to those places and say everything is just flowers and all the flowers are the same. We actually like the fact that roses are different from tulips and tulips are different from bluebonnets and bluebonnets are different from daisies. And we don't expect that they will all need the same water, the same type of soil, the same amount of sun. And we don't make that bad. And we do that with everything, right? Food, pets, you know, we do it with everything. But with humans, we have this story we make up, and often we only consciously make up stories about people or groups we think we don't like, and then we live by the story. So let's, like, we could just make up a different story. Or we could create a different story, or we could keep the story and just decide that the story does not define how I interact with person A, B, or C. So I'm not sure, like, how we make that happen worldwide, but it is an idea. I'm curious, too, about if we were able to move out or away from the stories and the labels as bad things, you know, where are those places? I mean, can you think of any place in your life where there are labels, but they're labels that work in a positive way instead of in a way to separate?
Well, sure. When a group of parents comes together in a PTA out of love and concern for the education of their children, some people see them as being divisive, and I think it's a loving thing for parents to do, to get interested in their children's education. So they may get labeled by school administrators as being a pain in the neck, or some other piece of anatomy. But the truth of the matter is that they have a common interest, and I think that when we start to look at groupings where there is a common interest that is based on love, that is based on family, that is based on children, then all of the other artificial barriers that we erect go away. Because I think that's part of the universal thread that connects all of us.
Yeah, you just triggered a thought for me, which is true, that I have been a member of groups where it felt like I was being invisible, that I was invisible or I was being ignored, and it felt that that was based on my race or my gender or my age or my profession. You know, something would be said or something would happen that would make me guess that that was what was happening. And there have been other times where none of those things made a difference, because what was more important or what was bringing us together was a particular either project goal or community goal. And so those ways that might have been viewed as undesirable in one group didn't matter at all in another group, because, as you said, there was a common interest, you know, based on love or children or a project goal or a deadline. And that overwrote, or that was a stronger motivator for us working together than the other aspects. So it's a really complicated thing, how we work together. You know, Stained Glass Spirit, our subtitle is Where Many Are One. And how do we build spiritual communities where many different kinds of people can be who they are and feel accepted and operate as one loving spiritual community? So that foundation is there, but even when we think that's a good idea, it's not always easy to do. So when you were part of a team, a work team that did have variety in ethnicity and education, in backgrounds and skills, is there anything specific that comes to mind that you either did that made that team work well together, or that you learned about working together with people who are really different from you?
Well, I think you just hinted at it. When we built adobe houses, and an adobe brick weighs 25 pounds, and so when the truck with 500 adobes on it would arrive, we'd have to move them, and we did that in a chain, and typically we threw them. So we stood about 6 feet apart and threw them from one person to the next. Well, it required rhythm. It required a certain amount of strength. However, I think what made it successful was that we always created a goal. And the goal was to say, we need to move these adobes so we can build the wall in the morning or later this afternoon, whatever the time frame was. And we were united in a common purpose. There was a theme to what we were doing. So it wasn't the strongest person. Everybody was a link in the chain.
Mm.
And then everybody got a break afterwards, because the truck had to leave and go get more adobes and come back so we could do it all over again. And but I think the uniting factor was that we were working together as a team with a common goal.
Yeah, you know, that sounds so simple, but it's so powerful. And how often does that not happen? I mean, we could think of lots of workplace situations, but let's think for a minute about a spiritual center or a church or a spiritual community. And everybody is coming together because they have and share some spiritual beliefs, or they're learning, you know, about some spiritual beliefs, a belief system. But that's not always the same as having a common purpose or a common goal. I'm just thinking, like, just processing that in this moment. I guess, so in the spiritual community that I am a member of, I guess in some ways the vision statement for, you know, for the individual community does, in if it's done well, does create a common purpose. In Centers for Spiritual Living, you know, the larger organization, that our vision and our purpose probably also serve that goal, to give us some common ground. As we say, our purpose is to awaken humanity to its spiritual magnificence, that creates a common purpose. Are we operating in a way that does that? I guess that would be the question, or would you ask a different question?
Well, I think there's no exclusion. To me, diversity has to do with acceptance and not excluding anybody. So the statement, awakening humanity to its spiritual magnificence, is not restricted in any way. It doesn't say, well, we're going to do this for old people, or we're going to do this for young people, or we're going to do this for brown people or black people or white people. It's awakening humanity, all of humanity, to its spiritual magnificence. And then that feeds into the vision of a world that works for everyone, not a world that works for a few of us, but a world that works for everyone. And that requires some effort. And I recently did some diversity training here in Santa Fe. And one of the things that we identified at our local center is that we don't have a real good practice of welcoming people in. We immediately cluster into groups of people that we know are friends, and we get busy catching up with what's gone on over the last week, because we're a fairly small, tight-knit community, and we know whose kid is graduating from college, and you know whose mother is in the hospital, and it's not meant to be exclusive, but people come in and say they don't feel welcome. So there's an example of where it's not anything that's being done consciously to exclude, but the behavior is read that way by other people. And once we know that, then we moved the greeter from the doors. We have a fellowship hall, so the doors to the sanctuary is where the greeter stood and welcomed people. Now we have somebody standing at the front door and welcoming them right then and there. And if they don't recognize them, and a few of us have taken on the responsibility, if there's somebody new, go over and introduce yourself and talk to them. Not after the service, but before the service.
I'm smiling because it's something as simple as that, right? That can make such a huge impact. One of the phrases that I use a lot when I am doing training is intent does not equal impact. So we can have the best intentions in the world, but if we're not aware of the impact our behavior has, we'll just keep doing the same thing and not so much pushing people away, but not really connecting with them in the way we'd like to. So your example is beautiful because it just took a little awareness of what the experience might be like for someone who's not already a part of the group, and one little small change. And I think moving toward inclusivity, moving toward inclusion, really is just that simple, often, not always, but often. Yeah, that's a great example. And it is in our behavior anyway. It's not just, we can believe and think lots of things, but that's in our mind or that's internal. People only know what we believe by what we actually do.
Yeah, it's that old adage with raising kids, that they're going to do what you do, not what you say. And I'm sure if you asked any of the people, you know, do you mean to be exclusive? Absolutely not. But it also, in my estimation, sometimes takes an effort to be inclusive.
So that makes me want to ask you this question. I've been in meetings with you where you have raised your hand and asked this question. Are we paying attention to diversity? Or it might be phrased a little bit differently, but it's basically the same question. Are we being inclusive? Did we look at diversity? How is that representing diversity? You take the effort, you make the effort to bring up the question, to ask the question. And so I'm curious, when did you start doing that, and why did you start doing that?
I'm not sure when I started doing it, but I had an experience when I was around 12 years old of being excluded and the awful feeling I had of when I was teased for a physical abnormality, and it left me feeling less than and incomplete, and I think the pain of that experience opened me up, and it was probably another, 20, 25 years before I found really an outlet for moving in the direction of sort of reversing that trend, because as a teenager, I was terrible. I mean, I was prejudiced, and about people that I had never met, people I didn't know, and it was just sort of that awful junior high school, trying to figure out who you are and making the differentiation on the basis of information that was totally invalid. And I grew up in pretty much a lily-white community in Rhode Island. I mean, there were no black people. There were no Jews. I mean, it was a bedroom community of Providence and had good schools, and that's why people moved there. And it was a white ghetto. And I didn't like who I was becoming in that process, because it was against my family values that I'd been taught, what I experienced. I mean, that and what I understood to be the right way to treat people, whether they were Portuguese or Italian, or didn't make any difference. They were all human beings.
Wow, I'm just taking that in, taking a deep breath, because so often people, others have experiences when they are in those middle school and high school years, and it shapes them, and then that becomes their norm. And I love that you can look back to that and realize that it wasn't comfortable for you, and it wasn't who you want to be in the world. And you clearly are not, that person now, in terms of all the different ways that you interact with people and lots of different folks. So, wow, I'm learning more about you, Walter Drew. I'm so delighted.
Well, I can tell you another thing, and I'm Anglos are in the minority in Santa Fe. We have a larger Spanish American population. Hispanic, if you will, and I feel, and I've lived here for 45 years, I still feel like a guest in this community, that this is, and I have children that were born here, and I've made my living here, and I've been of part of the fabric of the community. I ran for the school board, and I ran for the city council, and I served on committees, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I still have, and it's not even I'm sort of looking for a word. It's not that I feel second class. It's that I feel privileged to be in this place where people have been for 8 or 9 generations. And I came from that sort of background in New England, where there were old New England families, and possibly my father was one of those, except his grandfather got divorced, and there's a little break in the family history. He was in college before he found out that his grandfather hadn't died, that he'd gotten divorced. It was such an awful thing to say, and my mother was a German immigrant, so there was no long lineage, and I'm very respectful of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, what advice? And I don't use that word very often. So let me use a different word. What tips do you have for people to consider if they are in a leadership role and they want to either have conversations about or just create an environment where diversity is valued and inclusion becomes the way that they operate?
I think it, on an individual basis, I need to be aware of any labeling, any stereotyping that I do. And when I catch myself doing that, set that aside and pay attention to what the other person is saying. And I think that's where my mediation training has been invaluable to me, because when you're a mediator, you really have to listen past the emotional content to see if you can understand what's really underlying the issue. Is it a gender issue? Is it a age issue? So that you can find some way of weaving a common bond. But I think it's just basic respect and listening deeply and allowing the voices to be heard.
Yeah, that's powerful. And say more about listening past the emotional content, because I think most of us think that most of the time we're good listeners, but that's intriguing, listening past the emotional content to get to the underlying message.
Well, sometimes people can say, well, I hate so-and-so. You know, I don't like the way they treat me. I don't like this and I don't like that. And they're very emotional about it. I can't stand my neighbor's dog because it's always barking at night and keeps me from sleeping and drives me crazy. But then come to find out when push comes to shove, this person actually got bit by a dog when they were younger, and they're afraid of dogs. And so if you just listen to the emotional content, I can't stand my neighbor's dog, and you don't probe a little bit and have the opportunity to get to that next level of of understanding, well, then you're not going to be able to work on the, you're not going to be able to work out a resolution on the emotional basis, because the other person saying, you know, she's calling the cops and all the time, and our dog is not barking, it's the other neighbor's dog that's barking, and blah blah blah. It's amazing what you get into when you do these sorts of things. But then when you can find a common unity of humanness, I think all of us have things that we're a little bit scared of. I don't like bridges that go over water where there's a grill and you can see the water through the grill. There's such a bridge in Rhode Island, and even though I've probably been over it 100 times in my lifetime, I still, it bothers me. It doesn't strike me that it's safe. And other bridges don't bother me in the slightest, but and I don't even know why I'm talking about that. But it's a finding, I think it's that finding that point of common unity that allows us then to realize our humanity, and it has nothing to do with our outward stuff.
Yeah, or sometimes when we're trying to make a decision or we're complaining or demanding something change, and really it's reflecting something that is subconscious, or we're completely unconscious of the fact that what we're really reacting to is an experience or a belief from years and years ago that is not actually playing out in this situation. And I can imagine that that would come up a lot in our spiritual communities. I mean, I'm just thinking of a variety of situations that either people have shared with me or have asked me, you know, for some tips of how they can have the conversation in their spiritual community, where, you know, maybe you're really trying to attract young people to grow the community, and so you make changes to the music, and the people who've been a part of that community for 25 years or 20 years are like, we don't like the change in music. We like the music the way it was. It's always been that way, and why are we changing it now? And it's too loud, and the young people who are starting to come, they're like, that old music was like too quiet and too slow, and you know, I want something with a beat. I want to dance in the aisles. It's, you know, you just have a different, the conversation might start with, we don't like this, or it doesn't feel good, or it's hard for me to hear, or it's too loud. But really the issue is beneath that. How do we want to be in community together? And if we could find the common unity there, then of how we want to explore this thing called spiritual community together, then that would move us beyond the surface of the emotional content of how I feel or what I like and don't like. Is that, I mean, am I on the right track with the point you were trying to make? Does that example fit?
I think so, and I think that part of any healthy organization, and we can use the spiritual community, there needs to be a fairly well-defined methodology for conflict resolution. Because conflict is natural, it's inevitable, and it's not something to be managed. People talk about conflict management. Well, I don't want somebody managing me. Be it my wife or my boss or whoever it might be. But conflict resolution and developing those skills so you find a common answer. I mean, I'm sitting here and you're using that example of the music. Well, there are all sorts of possibilities for working that out. It doesn't have to be one way or the other way. Maybe half the music is appealing to the teenagers or the early 20s, and the other half, you know, there are ways to work these things out. But I think having the skills to honestly represent yourself and participate in the community, you have to have some level of conflict resolution skills. And I've seen you do that in group meetings that I've interacted with you. You know, you sometimes slow things down. You might ask a question for clarification or a better understanding just to shift the tone of what's going on. And I think that when you have a highly functioning group, it's everybody's responsibility to do that and to realize sometimes that, well, I've said the same thing three times and either nobody's listening or nobody cares. Maybe it's time for me to stop doing that. We learn a certain level of self-policing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hesitating because it's like, do I dare to ask this question out loud? And it's not a question of you. It's just a rhetorical question. Like when people are going through ministerial training, when people are going through training to become a licensed practitioner, when people volunteer to, as a laity person, to share or lead a ministry team, a sacred service ministry team, how much attention do we pay to ensuring they have the skills they need to resolve conflict? Because what you said is absolutely true. It's natural. It's, if you've got two people, let alone 200 people, there is inevitably going to be conflict at different levels at different times. And the more diversity you have in the group, the more prone you are in the short term to have conflict because people just have different experiences and perspectives. So it is a rhetorical question, but it's something for us to really think about, and you triggered it by the statement, which is true. Any healthy community must have a defined methodology for conflict resolution, and that requires skills as well as willingness.
And it can be in the form of agreements that, well, we're going to stay in the room and work this out. It's like any relationship you're involved with. You always have the option of, you know, packing your bags and moving on. I mean, that's part of the process of life. I mean, we leave home and we start our own homes and. Some people do it sooner. I have a son who's 23 who graduated from college a couple of years ago, and he's living at home, and that's not an issue. He's a very responsible citizen and working two jobs, and it's kind of fun to have him around. And it's also fun to see that he's starting to say, well, this place is getting a little small, not our family unit, but his hometown, and he's working as a waiter in a very busy New Mexican food restaurant that's very successful, and he's making good money, but it's not a career path.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what strikes me is, you used the phrase stay in the room and then the idea of stay in the relationship. And what struck me was, you know, in the in the U.S. specifically, if not all of North America, but definitely in the U.S., when we know that way more than 50% of marriages end in divorce, it just strikes me that we actually have not embedded in our culture this concept of, well, we've moved away from the concept of you are going to have conflict and you deal with it and you work it out together, because we now, more than 50% of people who get married actually get divorced because they don't know how to resolve conflict. So no wonder when we put a lot of people together in a spiritual community that a lot of people don't have the skills, let alone, you know, the desire or commitment, but they don't have the skills or experience to know how to work through the kinds of conflicts that come up from people who mean well, but simply are challenged by the fact that they are in spiritual community with folks who are different from themselves. And I don't think I've really ever thought about it in that framework before. So I'm glad we're having this conversation, because so much of what turns into conflict just occurs because we don't know how to work through it. We don't know how to talk through it. We don't know how to resolve it. So from a perspective of diversity and inclusion, I'm going to ask the wise Mr. Walter Drew if he has any ideas about things that we could do or a minister could do that would, any other additional things that a minister could do or a leader in a spiritual community could do to build a bridge, really, to build a bridge between members and participants who have different backgrounds.
Well, I clearly think that, let's take Centers for Spiritual Living, where we say that we're an inclusive community, then we need to honor and celebrate other religious holidays. We acknowledge Passover, we acknowledge Easter. They may not be part of our specific tradition, but they have certain mythological values. But we also... So that's one aspect of it, celebrating the religious backgrounds that most people bring to New Thought. They were raised something else, and there's that sort of silly, well, I'm a recovering Catholic, or I'm a recovering Lutheran, or we're all human beings. Nobody's really in recovery from anything. We're just exploring life. But not only celebrating other faith traditions, but celebrating all of the elements, the young people, the old people, men and women, gays and non-gays, and whatever the various distinctions are, I would think that... If I were to be a minister, I would create a healthy atmosphere where conflict resolution was not based on something like what I was raised with in the 50s, father knows best, just wait until your father gets home. So that's changed, you know, the role of women. I mean, but then I think the other thing to do is to get people in service together, with a common bond, and those things sort of drop away. And I'm not talking about big esoteric projects. I'm talking about doing good old church supper and, you know, people setting up the tables and people being in community together and taking responsibility and bringing the food and sharing the food. And I mean, there's some very basic things that all of us do. We all eat, and we all celebrate our children and our elders, hopefully. I'm moving in that direction. but I think this idea of developing skills for conflict resolution can make for healthy communities. It can make for healthy relationships. I'm one of those people that fall in that 50% category of being divorced. And I've actually been married the second time longer than I was the first time. And the first time I was married for 22 years, and Barbara and I are coming up on 25.
Yay.
We work on it. We work at it. And we acknowledge, you know, it's not always easy. But we've set up some practices, and we try to get things resolved within 24 hours. And we greet each day, as a new opportunity. And I would say the great majority of the time that's successful, but every so often one of us will just be ornery enough to hang on to something from the day before. But by and large, we made that a goal, that really there was nothing so important that, you know, we couldn't just lay it down and, you know, sleep on it and move on the next day.
That is wise advice, Walter Drew. So I want to shift where our time is beginning to wind down. We have about 5 more minutes total. And it just strikes me, this question, I hadn't planned to ask it because I didn't think of it until now. So what, if anything, would you like your legacy to be in the context of diversity and inclusion? You know, like, the next generation is hearing the stories about Walter Drew in the community, or Walter Drew as an influential leader in Centers for Spiritual Living, or Walter Drew as a parent and grandparent. I mean, what? And I'm rambling a little bit to give you a moment to think, but what would you like your legacy to be in the context of diversity and inclusion?
I would like my legacy to be that I was generous with all people, and that I had an ability to see the nobility in all people, and that I treated all people with respect and took an extra little effort to make a personal connection with as many people as I possibly could.
Wow. So, 2 things. Number one, this conversation inspired that question, and I'm probably going to ask that question at the end of every one of these conversations, because it's an amazing question just to hear where people come from. The other wow is that I have been a recipient. I can tell you that this legacy is exactly what your behavior is generating in the world. I have been a recipient of your extra effort to reach out and to build a bridge. And I will be aspiring to see the nobility in all people. I love that line, and I'll be quoting you on that. And you are living in a way, I attest to that. You are living in a way that this absolutely is a legacy that I could imagine people using to describe you. So keep up the good work, Walter Drew.
Well, thank you. And I can give a personal example. I mean, you are a woman of color. I don't see it. I don't even think of you from a gender standpoint. You're my friend. And we don't always have the same idea of how something should be, but I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, and I'm interested in your perspective, and I don't discount you in any way because of your gender or because of your color or because you live in Dallas, Texas. And I mean, there's so many ways that we discount people. I celebrate your intelligence, your willingness, your gusto for life, what you're doing right here this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you. And that is exactly what it's not so much not seeing the differences, but absolutely not discounting people based on what the story might be about the different identities that make up, you know, each one of us, and having models like you to, you know, remind us that it's possible to interact with people as individuals and look for the good in them. And that's what it means to be intentionally inclusive. I could not have, like, brought this together in any better way, but what you just described and how you are in the world is a great example of being intentionally inclusive. And I appreciate your willingness to have this conversation with me. I'm sure a lot of people will be touched by it. And that's really about all the time that we have for this episode of Intentionally Inclusive. I appreciate each one listening. And again, for more information, please visit stainedglassspirit.net and see the list of how to link to all of the other conversations as well as other workshops and webinars and classes that are available if you, like me, are passionate about diversity, inclusion, and spirituality and where they intersect. Thanks, Walter.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.